Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. This week, I'll be bringing you a selection from a new audiobook that was recently published on the Maverick American Mercury website. But first, I want to remind you that this week, especially February 14, Valentine's Day, is the high point of the National Alliance Love Your Race campaign. It's a campaign that leverages our usual rightness and common sense with an irrefutable idea, and which essentially forces our people's enemies to reveal their hateful agenda when they denounce us. Our classic version of the Love Your Race flyer is available in many different languages, as we'll show you in the text version of this broadcast. And we also have two additional downloadable and printable versions of the flyer, which you can download for free too. Your local print shop can make these look totally professional and impressive. So get out there and do your duty this week. Awaken our people and bring them into our fold. Make the National Alliance stronger than it's ever been before. For 100 years and more, Jewish groups have lied and promoted a false narrative in an effort to disempower and dispossess other races, most notably our race, but also others. A century ago, one of the most notable and earliest instances of their use of the mass media to deceive us on a nationwide scale was the Leo Frank case, in which they made a sex pervert, rapist, and strangler of a 13-year-old white girl into a martyr and a quote-unquote victim of anti-Semitism. Almost no one today knows just how egregiously they lied. But our efforts and a new and well-researched book from a black separatist group are breaking through the wall of censorship. The audiobook excerpt we'll be presenting today gives us a glimpse of just how bad it really was. From the American Mercury, "The criminal acts of the Leo Frank forces as they attempted to get a new trial for their client or invalidate the results of the original trial in which Leo Frank was convicted are so numerous, so outrageous, so obvious, and so egregious that once you hear about them in this new audiobook, you will be outraged at how academia and the media have kept these facts from you. Did you know an attempt was made to pay an inmate to poison one of the state's main witnesses, James Conley? Poisoning, bribery, subornation of perjury, and much, much more. In fact, it's fair to say that chicanery on this scale comes very close to proving that Frank was guilty, and that his legal slash propaganda slash dirty tricks team knew he was guilty, for these are not the acts of innocent men with clear consciences. We also will learn in this audiobook about the judicial condemnation of Leo Frank's legal team, another thing that today's media accounts and academic studies of the Frank case leave out. This is just one of 29 audio segments of this groundbreaking work, originally published on the American Mercury, which is based on the Racial Nationalist Nation of Islam book series called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. Volume 3 is entitled The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. And this book will take you on a trip into the past to the greatest American murder mystery of all time, a mystery that will reveal to you the hidden forces that shape our world even today. Listen.
Carter's Murder for Hire. Annie Maud Carter had much more to say about her association with Leo Frank and his crew, and revealed damning information that scholars of the case have heretofore ignored. Not only had this black woman publicly repudiated the letters Frank claimed she had exchanged with James Conley, but she revealed in a sworn affidavit that Frank's friends had actually tried to recruit her to poison Conley. She named two individuals: National Pencil Company stockholder Oscar Pappenheimer and Milton Klein, of Daniel Klein and Son, the B'nai B'rith member, who publicly took credit for hiring William J. Burns. Even the New York Times, a certified member of the Frank team, had to report in its May 6, 1914 issue on the, quote, poison plot against Conley, end quote. Quote, one day, while walking past Frank's cell block, one of Frank's friends came up to, end quote, Carter, quote, and asked her if she wanted to get rich right quick. She said that the man asked her if she ever visited Jim Conley's cell. She said she answered that she was going there then. Thereupon, according to the affiant, end quote, Carter, quote, the friend of Frank said, in effect, take this vial and be mighty careful of it. Don't get any of it on you. It is dangerous. Just put a drop in the food that is given Conley. The woman said she replied that she did not want to have anything to do with killing anybody, and that Frank's friend said that she should not care anything about one Negro less, especially who had put the Fagin crime on Frank. She said she did not know this man's name, but that he had black hair and wore his hat pulled down over his eyes. She said she had seen him in company with a man by the name of Pappenheimer, and that he had come to Frank's cell with the Klein boys. End quote. None of this was ever pursued, either legally by the Georgia justice system or academically by students of the Leo Frank case. Many scholars are willing to validate her, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, about the letters before Carter repudiated them in open court, but not her explicit testimony under oath about a murder-for-hire plot by the friends of Leo Frank. All of Georgia watched this entire Burns burlesque unravel before their eyes in the retrial hearing for Leo Frank. Judge Benjamin Hill did not even need to hear arguments from prosecutor Hugh Dorsey before he denied Frank a new trial and set in motion an investigation into the tactics and methods of William J. Burns. More Burns chicanery. By May of 1914, Annie Maud Carter had pulled the bandage off a festering wound, only to expose an underworld operation of major proportions. So many witnesses, dredged up by Burns's dragnet, were so plainly fraudulent that scholars today are embarrassed to mention them. The, quote, respected white preacher, end quote, named C.B. Ragsdale admitted that his, quote, two darkies, end quote, were complete fabrications and that Frank's team had paid him to lie. Quote, they were just handing money out, end quote, charged the clergyman. He had received $200 for his, quote, darkies, end quote, story, a half year's pay for most of Frank's factory employees. A black woman named Mary Rich operated a lunch stand near the factory. On the day the murder was discovered, police found the basement door to the alleyway had been unlatched, and they later charged that Frank had unlocked the door to enable Conley to get in to burn the body of Mary Fagin. Burns claimed that he had an affidavit from Mary Rich admitting that she had served Conley at 2:20 p.m. on the day of the murder after seeing him emerge from the alleyway next to the factory. But nobody told Mary Rich, and she charged that the story was invented by none other than the local rabbi, David Marks, and Frank's own wife, Lucille. Quote, Mrs. Frank said to me, "If you will sign this affidavit, you will take the rope from around my husband's neck." End quote. Two other blacks charged that the Frank team simply forged their names on falsified affidavits. Yet another white woman detailed the efforts made, quote, "to get her out of town," end quote. Efforts that included an offer of $100 and a marriage proposal from an agent hired by Frank and using an alias. Much of the money, when it could be traced, seemed to come from Herbert J. Haas, Frank's other Jewish lead attorney, who was the conduit for Lasker's secret funds. But that is not all. Some of William J. Burns' ham-fisted attempts to pressure and bribe witnesses on Frank's behalf occurred at Governor Slayton's law firm and in Governor Slayton's own office. In the end, Leo Frank's perjurious house of cards collapsed very publicly and completely. His manufactured, quote, revelations, end quote, only fortified everyone's confidence in the original guilty verdict, and layered upon that conviction new felonies, expanding the associated pool of criminals to include even more friends, associates, and hires of Leo M. Frank. William J. Burns so completely botched the task that he and his agents soon faced charges of subornation of perjury, quote, hiding a Negro witness, end quote, bribery, inventing evidence, and buying testimony. Illegalities that led to a revocation of Burns' license to practice in Atlanta. Proving himself to be the ultimate recanter, a remorseful Burns appeared in court and, quote, distanced himself from, end quote, the Annie Maud Carter letters, in effect admitting they were faked. Attorney Reuben Arnold also repudiated the letters, saying in court, quote, Conley isn't a pervert, end quote. Quote, I don't believe there has been any perversion in the case on the part of Conley or of Frank, end quote. Georgia's favorite son, Tom Watson, was monitoring all this in the pages of his weekly Jeffersonian. He mercilessly mocked the, quote, great detective, end quote, whom he renamed simply, quote, the jackass, end quote. Quote, I think I said that Burns might trace a lost cow, if she had a bell on her neck and toted a red light lantern on her tail. I now take that back. I was too hasty. My revised opinion is that Burns couldn't even find a lost cow unless she were equipped with a wireless telegraph outfit and regularly flashed out SOS signals every time she stopped to make water. End quote. Lewis Marshall despaired at the collapse of his team's efforts, privately calling Burns' methods, quote, ridiculous, end quote, and, quote, farcical, end quote, and, quote, a burlesque, end quote. He said he was, quote, disgusted, end quote, that Burns brought the case, quote, to this point of destruction, end quote. Tellingly, Marshall was not repudiating Leo Frank's blatantly racist defense strategy. He was simply scoring Burns' incompetence in carrying out his part of their racist plot. Even attorney Herbert Haas, ignoring his own role as Lasker's bagman in the fiasco, had to admit that, quote, Burns' connection with the case has done us irretrievable damage, end quote. The sleazy conduct of Leo Frank's private eyes. Some of the Burns operatives were forced to stand trial for just a portion of the avalanche of illegalities that included fraud, bribery, perjury, forgery, and even murder for hire. None of the higher-ups orchestrating the treachery. Lasker, Haas, Ox, Marshall, Marks, Frank were ever held accountable for their roles in the bizarre episode. Only Tom Watson held them up for public ridicule in his monthly magazine. Quote, decidedly, it is the blackest record of systematic effort to save the guilty, destroy the innocent, debauch witnesses, manufacture evidence, and create a public sentiment in favor of a fictitious case. End quote. Judge Hill scored the, quote, famous sleuths, end quote, who were seeking, quote, not truth, but money and notoriety, end quote. He called them, quote, a menace to justice, end quote, and declared, quote, these men do not detect crime. Rather, they encourage crime. They are a menace to the peace of the state and an obstruction to the administration of justice, end quote. Albert Lasker finally admitted in 1937 what everyone already knew in 1914. Quote, Burns cost me $25,000 out of my own pocket, and, by God, he put in as much perjured stuff as the other side did before we finished. I don't say he did, and he had his operatives, I guess. You can run that sort of a thing, until it embarrassed our case at times. End quote. Lasker is here admitting to a serious felony for which he was never indicted. Judge Benjamin Hill talked tough, assessed fines, but in a surprising move, he dismissed some of the charges and ordered no prison time for Burns's gaggle of operatives. Turns out, Lasker may have persuaded Judge Hill into granting Frank's felons an undeserved leniency. In a private letter to cohort Adolf Ox, dated March 12, 1914, Lasker seemed to be assessing the opportunity for judicial bribery. Quote, the situation looks serious, for I found that Judge Hill comes up for re-election in June. He has a large family to support, and it is but 4 months since he resigned a position in a higher court, where the salary was $4,000 a year, to fill a vacancy by appointment in this lower court at $5,000 a year. This would not seem to augur well. End quote. There is no proof that any money changed hands, but it is hard to believe that Lasker's blatant query about the judge's personal finances could have had any other purpose. Below is a chart that catalogs the illegalities which have come to light that can be directly attributed to the Leo Frank legal team. Catalog of corruption. Dishonest, unethical, criminal behaviors of Leo Frank's defense team. Much of the data in this chart was drawn from the article, quote, W.J. Burns and Dan Lehan summoned by Solicitor Dorsey to the Frank retrial hearing, end quote. Atlanta Constitution, May 2, 1914. The article's subtitle of this pro-Frank paper is telling, quote, forgery, bribery, trickery, intimidating witnesses, threatening to expose scandals of girls, all made against men who are working for the defense. End quote. The editor might easily have added conspiracy to murder a witness. Burns never produced his promised report and reportedly burned all his files on the Leo Frank case. Charge. Bribery of George Epps. Description. The 14-year-old Epps testified that Mary Fagan told him that Leo Frank had made sexual advances toward her. Burns's private detective, C.W. Burke, offered him money to change his testimony. Charge. Attempted bribery of Marie Karst. Description. The former National Pencil Company employee had testified at trial that Frank's, quote, character for lasciviousness was bad, end quote. Karst now testified that Burke and Leo Frank's factory employee, Lemmy Quinn, had come to her home with liquor, intending to get her to agree to come to the office of Frank's lawyers. She refused. Then Burke met her on the street and offered her a job for $2 a day. Quote, Burke wanted me to go around and see the girls who had sworn for the state in the Frank trial and see if they would not change their evidence. He told me that what I swore to did not bind me because I was not cross-examined and said it was not recorded. I saw several of the girls, and they told me they would not change their evidence because what they swore to was true. Burke wanted me to see Montine Stover and talk with her and see if I couldn't get her to change her evidence. He wanted me to go down and live with Montine and pick her. My mother refused to let me do it and would not let me work for Burke anymore. End quote. Charge: attempted bribery of Albert McKnight. Description: McKnight, husband of the cook at Frank's home, was offered money and employment at high wages if he would swear that the injuries he had sustained in a railroad accident was caused by a beating by Atlanta detectives. Charge: attempted bribery of Aaron Allen. Description: William Burns brought Allen, a black man, to Chicago for several days, pressuring him to swear that Conley had confessed to him that he alone had committed the murder. Allen refused, despite large sums of money left on a table that were his for the taking. Charge: blackmailing of Carrie Smith. Description: private detective C.W. Burke threatened Smith with exposure of alleged misconduct at her place of employment if she did not change her trial statement, in which she testified of Leo Frank's bad character. Smith, a factory employee for 3 years, swore that she was offered $20 to sign an affidavit favorable to Frank, $500 in today's dollars. The person bribing her was a, quote, Mr. Maddox, end quote. Very likely Burke, using an assumed name, who made the offer in Governor Slayton's private office. She was also expected to try to stealthily become a roommate of Montine Stover's to persuade her to change her testimony. Charge: attempted bribery of Mrs. Maggie Nash. Description: Mrs. Nash swore that Burns had tried to get her to change her testimony about seeing Frank go into a private room with a female employee. She refused, telling Burns, quote, he might try 100 years, end quote, but she would never do it. Charge: attempted bribery of Helen Ferguson. Description: factory employee Ferguson testified that Frank had refused to give her Mary Fagan's pay envelope. It was this refusal, on Friday evening, that compelled Mary to go to Frank herself to collect her pay the next day, whereupon she was murdered. Ferguson swore that Jimmy Wren, who worked for C.W. Burke, offered her $100 and all her expenses, $2,500 in today's dollars, if she would leave Atlanta. She said that Wren tried to persuade her to marry him and introduced her to his, quote, father, end quote. He, quote, said he wanted to marry me, but wanted me to sign an affidavit first, end quote. Wren's, quote, father, end quote, was Frank's private detective, C.W. Burke. Charge: attempted bribery of C.B. Dalton. Description: at the trial, Dalton confirmed Conley's account of Frank's sexual encounters. He swore that C.W. Burke had offered him $100 to sign a paper, quote, to be used before the pardon board to keep Frank from hanging, end quote. He said he had gone to Dublin, Georgia, to do some work for a bank, and two Jews came to him and offered him $400 to leave the state. They came to him several times and renewed the offer, stating that they meant to get Frank a new trial. Charge: forged evidence. Description: Annie Maud Carter was used by Burns' agents to agree to claim to have received obscene letters from James Conley. Charge: conspiracy to murder James Conley. Description: according to Annie Maud Carter, quote, a Jew came up, Mr., end quote, Oscar, quote, Pappenheim was there too, end quote, and offered a large sum of money if she would put poison in James Conley's food. Charge: forged evidence. Description: Frank's team forged the time slip of factory night watchman Newt Lee to make it appear that he had time to leave the factory on the night of the murder. Charge: planted evidence. Description: a shirt wiped in blood was planted at the home of Newt Lee, a deception that made him the target of lynching threats. Lee was fully exonerated, and it was established that the bloody shirt was planted by Frank's legal team. Charge: planted evidence. Description. Wooden club, quote, found, end quote, by Pinkerton detectives in a previously searched area of the factory was claimed by Frank to be the murder weapon used by Conley. Factory employee Wade Campbell, however, testified at the trial that on the day of the murder, Frank, quote, had a club which he used to play with in his hand, and he was carrying it around, end quote.
Be with us again next week for part two of A Century of Jewish Lies, right here on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. The National Alliance is working to educate white men and women around the world as to the nature of the reality we must face, and organizing our people to ensure our survival and advancement. We need your help to continue. Please send the largest contribution you can afford to National Alliance, Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. You can also help us by visiting natall.com/donate. That's natall.com/donate. Once again, our postal address is Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. You can abbreviate Tennessee, TN. Until next time, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to never give up.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout.